Welcome to The Final Draft. I'm Genevieve McGregor. Last week was Australian Book Week, now in its 66th year. And to celebrate tonight, we'll be airing an interview of a different sort to celebrate. Final drafter Martin Hewitson and his 8-year-old daughter Eve Hewitson interview young adult author Richard Newsom. We also talk with Paris-based journalist, now author, Caroline Brothers about her first novel, Hinterland, which is about the almost invisible, dangerous journey many children from war-torn Afghanistan and Somalia make across Europe in search of a better life. And finally, a review of Jane Eyre, the book and the latest adaptation to film, all coming up on The Final Draft.
Sydney Roller Derby League presents its home season finals, Reservoir Derby. Bout 7 of Sydney's home season will bring an amazing night of derby to the Horton Pavilion on Saturday, September 3. Starting the night off, last year's winners, the Sydney Assault Sirens, will go on the attack against the Deviants to secure their places on the leadership board. And the game not to be missed this year, SRDL's two new home teams, the Beauty School Knockouts, will go out shaking their pom-poms against the undefeated glittery gold Team Unicorn, the Horny Rollers, for the coveted season trophy. See SydneyRollerDerby.com for ticket and transport details. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. 2SER is a proud media partner of Sydney Roller Derby League.
Australian Book Week is also Australia's longest-running children's festival. Every year, schools and public libraries all over the country celebrate books by Australian authors and illustrators and the joy and benefits of reading. One keen reader we know of is 8-year-old Eve Hewitson, who loved the first two parts of Richard Newcombe's The Billionaire's Curse so much she wanted to talk to him. Eve spoke with Richard recently and asked him how long it takes to write a novel.
Well, the first book I did, The Billionaire's Curse, took me almost 10 years, which is not recommended if you want to have a long career. But the second book, The Emerald Casket, that took me about 1 year. So I've now figured out exactly the process I need to do. So about 12 months from go to woe.
My second question is, where do you normally get your ideas from?
Well, my ideas come from all over the place. I like to think that an author's mind is a bit like a pair of farmer's socks, because a farmer at the end of the day after walking around the paddocks and working in the fields comes home and he peels his boots off and his socks are just covered in burrs and prickles and things like that. And I think an author's mind is a bit like that. You just pick up stuff as you walk around, and I was using experiences from my own childhood, experiences from my work days as a media professional, just all sorts of bits and pieces, you know, newspaper articles I see that I clip out and tuck away, conversations I overhear, they just come from all over, and eventually they sort of form this soup that you stir around and try to get a cohesive story out the other end.
How many times do you normally rewrite a book?
Yeah, rewriting, it's pretty important. I write the first draft in longhand, in pencil, in a notebook, and that normally takes me about 3 months, and then I type that up into my computer and sort of edit it as I go, and that'll take me another 6 weeks or so, and then I'll print that out and edit it again and again, and then I'll probably edit one more time. Then I'll send it off to my editor, who'll have a go at it. So I guess by the time it gets published, it's probably been edited and rewritten in parts around about 7 or 8 times. So it does take a while.
What ideas do you have for after the Billionaire's Curse books?
After that series is over, I'm working on a new series at the moment that I can't give too much away about, but it's it does involve outer space. So I'm again looking at kids who are getting into a bit of trouble, but not on planet Earth, on other planets elsewhere, and I think it's going to be a bit of fun.
Oh, do you think after you've written the third book, are you going to write a fourth?
In the Billionaires series, I think once the third book is finished, and that's where Gerald, the lead character, sort of solves the big mystery that's been dogging him for the previous two books, I think that pretty well ties that up nicely, though there is certainly potential there for more adventures, because, I mean, Gerald is a 13-year-old billionaire, so he's bound to have more adventures, I would have thought. So, yeah, certainly maybe further down the track I could do another one.
Okay. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Thank you, Evie.
That was Richard Newsom talking with 8-year-old Eve Hewitson, who surely must be 2SER's youngest contributor. Now, Richard Newsom's The Billionaire's Curse was the first part of a trilogy. He's already released the second part, which was The Emerald Casket, and the third and final part is due out to be released next month. Final Draft's Martin Hewitson, the father of Eve, spoke to him recently and began by asking him whether he thought there was a resurgence in young adult and children's literature.
I'm not sure if there's a resurgence or if it's always just been there bubbling away under the surface, because I know when I first started putting pen to paper to try to put my book into reality, I wasn't very aware of what else was being written until I started going into the bookstores and doing a bit of research to see actually what was being published. And I was really surprised just to see how much there was there and how much of it was from Australian authors. And it doesn't get a lot of coverage in the traditional review sections of newspapers, where the kids and young adults, if they mention it at all, in sort of some small ghetto sort of down the bottom of the page. So you can get the impression that there's not a lot around, but actually there is, and luckily there's a lot of very supportive librarians out there who are very keen to support local authors, and you go to literary festivals and all these people who are producing books are there in their dozens and dozens talking to the kids, and it's quite a vibrant scene.
Okay, so does the fact that young adult literature doesn't actually get as much publicity and media attention as traditional novels, does that make it more difficult to actually, I suppose, make a living from it?
I guess it depends. I mean, there are some child literature authors who make a very good living in Australia. People like Andy Griffiths, who have been writing for a very long time and have a very long list of books to their credit. At these literary festivals, when at the author signing tables, the queue will go three times around the building and then out into the street for people like Andy. So he's very successful. And Morris Gleitzman and James Maloney, other Australian authors who've made a very good living out of it. And then there are others who are at the very beginning of their career, such as me, who are just sort of starting out. And it can be, if you're relying purely on sales in Australia, it would be a struggle. But luckily I've had a bit of success in getting my books placed overseas, so that helps getting them into bigger marketplaces, so the royalties can begin to add up.
So you talked about rights sold overseas. Which countries have picked up The Billionaire's Curse?
Into the US, Canada, Germany, Poland, Spain, and Turkey and Italy. I think that's the list so far.
Yeah, because I was wondering when I actually read the first one that even though you're an Australian author, I mean, most of it's actually set in London. It's like there's this tiny little section in Australia and it's immediately on a plane. I mean, is that just the way it came out? Or
well, it was a deliberate thing because I wanted the lead character, Gerald, I wanted him out of his comfort zone. So I thought the best place to do that would be to get him out of the country and in amongst a bunch of people who he didn't know, so he had to get by on his wits. So it was just a device, I guess, to put a bit of pressure on him. And then, of course, as the story progresses, the pressure ratchets up higher and higher, and he has to sort of respond appropriately to survive. It was very much a plan to take him, extract him from Australia, and move him into another place where he was unfamiliar.
Okay, and clearly you're familiar with London.
Yes, my wife still doesn't really believe me, but I did take a research trip to the UK for a couple of weeks several years ago to research, because the book opens in the British Museum in the reading room there, and I'd read plenty about that, but I just wanted to see it and experience it so I could properly describe it. So I spent a very enjoyable couple of weeks wandering around London and down to Somerset, to Glastonbury, to get a feel of the countryside, so I could adequately describe it for the book.
And you said that was several years ago, so, I mean, could I say, I mean, you won the text inaugural prize, didn't you?
Yes, that's right.
So was that life-changing, I suppose, is the main question?
Oh, completely. It had taken me from the day I first picked up a pencil to start writing the story to seeing it on a bookshelf in a bookstore. It was 10 years. So it was a labour of love that turned into an obsession, and it had been, when I finished the book, it was rejected by about a dozen or more literary agents who I submitted it to. They weren't keen on it. And it was only when I saw this tiny little article about the text prize in the newspaper saying they were looking for manuscripts, unpublished manuscripts for children's and YA books, and first prize was to get the book published, a book contract. And I thought, well, I've written this thing, I might as well send it in. And they had something like 350 entries for that first year of the competition, and that was back in 2008. And I was shortlisted, and then I won. So, yeah, when I got the phone call, it was my Olympic gold medal moment. That was it was an extraordinary thing to happen.
Yeah, it sounds like you'd already spent the check before you won the competition.
Several times over, sadly. It has, I mean, seriously been quite transformational for me, because I was then able to sell another couple of books, because it's a three-part series. So Tex very kindly bought the whole series, and then have on-sold into all those other territories. So I've now get fan emails from Poland, from Germany, from Canada and the US and New Zealand. It's really quite amazing.
Okay, so yeah, because I mean, that was actually going to be my next question, because I mean, the first one ends and there's like quite a big cliffhanger and the bad guys disappeared and stuff. So I mean, were you originally intending to write it as a trilogy?
Oh, very much so. And I actually purposefully left the ending of the first book quite open in the draft stage to whet the appetite of whoever was reading it to hopefully buy the other two books, which I hadn't written at that point, but I had totally plotted out. I knew exactly what was going to happen, but it was always going to be a story that was going to take three parts to tell it.
There seems to be a great many like adult novelists who are now having their go at writing children's novels. I'm thinking like John Grisham's got his second one coming out shortly, like Carl Hiaasen's, I think, you know, the Florida-based detective writer, he's written three now. Jeanette Winterson has written one, Nick Hornby. There seems to, I mean, is it just me, but does there seem to be an awful lot of people thinking, oh, I'll have a go at writing children's novels now?
I think it's a category that had been ignored a little bit by the publishing fraternity until the Harry Potter thing happened, and then that just woke up the whole industry to, you know, gosh, there's kids out there and they read and they want to read more than just Enid Blyton, which had been sort of the mainstay, or Roald Dahl. And there's a real thirst at that 9 through 12 year olds, which is the area that I aim my books at. There's a massive thirst for kids to read. You know, they do tend to stop reading in year 9, say, at high school, when all the other temptations of life kick in. But at that pre-adolescent age, when everything is still a golden age for kids, they've got such a thirst for books and good stories and great imagination, and I really like, I love, that's why I chose that that little segment to write for. But I think you know, the industry woke up, gosh, there's a big readership out there, we were able to sell these books in high volumes, and a lot of authors probably now have kids in that age group themselves, so they can see, oh well, now I can understand my audience a bit better and write to it. I mean, my eldest daughter Ruby has been my unofficial unpaid editorial consultant since this whole process started, and she helps me a lot just in you know, how a person would form a sentence or use what words they might use, and she's always the first person to read my manuscripts once I finish.
When's the third one coming out?
The third one, I'm working on that at the very last stages now. It's due out in October of this year, and it is called The Mask of Destiny, which has a nice sort of romping type of ring to it. And yeah, that comes out in October, and then subsequently in another 18 months or so overseas.
That was Richard Newsome talking with Martin Hewitson. You're tuned in to The Final Draft on 2SER. Coming up, a review that may shock some diehard Charlotte Bronte fans. Katrina Menzies-Pike sinks her teeth into the latest film adaptation of Jane Eyre. But first, Caroline Brothers' first novel, Hinterland, opens at night with two boys crossing a river in a blow-up dinghy. This river is also a border. They have nothing but the clothes on their backs, their inheritance stitched into the lining of a belt, and the hope that Europe will offer them a better life. Travelling by truck, by boat, by train, by bus and on foot from war-torn Afghanistan, the dangerous journey of Aryan and his younger brother Kabir is one taken by an alarming number of displaced children, some alone, some with family members. Surprisingly, this is almost unknown by many Europeans already anxious about illegal immigration. Caroline Brothers is based in Paris and writes for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. While covering migration, she was shocked by the ages of some of the children she met. I started my interview with Caroline by asking her how she first came across these kids.
I kind of encountered them without really realizing what I was seeing. You know, I was in Calais. We were doing a story on illegal immigration and refugees trying to cross through to England. And I just noticed amongst the crowd of adults that I was interviewing that there were a couple of children. There was an 8-year-old boy traveling with a brother of about 16. And then there was another 8-year-old boy with an uncle, I think it was. And then you just sort of see them and you think, ooh, they're pretty small, but it took me a while to put together the fact that these weren't just isolated incidents of young people, that there was this whole community made of people on the move, includes a whole demographic of very young people, you know, minors under the age of 18, many around 14, 15, and some as young as 8. And the youngest that I met on their own, totally on their own, was 12 years old. You know, it just kind of blew my mind, really.
Your first realization that there were these children traveling put you on quite an interesting journey, it seems. What research was involved in this story? Did you seek out other children across Europe to talk to?
The easiest place for me to talk to them was in Paris, because there's an emergency or a temporary shelter that's been set up for them. So you have a group of them and you can speak to several and you can go back over a few days and meet them. And then in Calais, I met them, but I wasn't reporting specifically on children. So the awareness kind of came later on, mainly in Paris, when I realized that there was this emergency shelter, so that there was a place that I could go to reconnect with them. And then I put it together with the other interviews that I'd done, realizing that I had more material than even I'd kind of guessed. So it kind of came about almost in a back to front way, sort of seeing them and not understanding what I was seeing until later on when I was in Paris and saw that there was this structure there. Mm. And that's how it kind of came together.
And can you tell us a bit about these kids? Obviously they can be very young, but where are they coming from and what kind of journey are they going through?
That's a good question. Many of them are Afghan. Around the world, in fact, the number of children asking for asylum, they tend to come from Afghanistan and from Somalia. So the ones that we're meeting in Europe commonly are Afghan kids. But there's many of them have fled Afghanistan some time ago and have been, like, their families have left and they've been living in refugee camps in Pakistan and Iran. So some of them have only very tenuous memories of Afghanistan itself, but clearly culturally and their families are Afghan. But I was mainly focused on the Afghan ones just because they were the ones that I was meeting most frequently. It's 6,000 kilometres from Kabul to Calais. They do this journey by foot, by truck, by boat, by train, by bus, crouched in the false bottoms of gravel trucks. I mean, the most horrendous type journeys these kids are embarking on. I mean, some of them travel just gripping the chassis of trucks behind the axle, just gripping onto the little ledge that they find there. I mean, it's just, you know, all manner of kind of clandestine travel methods they take, and you know, they get sent back across a border, and then they go ahead on foot. You know, some are walking through the snow. Even before they get to the European Union, they've had a very harrowing journey just to get as far as Turkey. You know, they've crossed mountains in the night time, and you know, they're told it's like an overnight walk, and in fact it's 3 days through the snow and people perish on the route. I mean, it's just makes your hair stand on end what they've been through.
Immigration and asylum seekers, it's quite an explosive topic, both here in Australia but particularly in Europe at the moment. I mean, we're seeing hundreds of people arriving in Italy every week, for example, mostly young men from northern Africa. What is the sentiment amongst Europeans, most Europeans that you've spoken to about these people?
It's very divided. I mean, Europeans feel that they should be supporting these democracy movements in North Africa, but there's been a whole to-ing and fro-ing between Italy and France, because they're worried. They're always worried about what they call massive influxes of people across borders, and so the people have been crossing and then pushed back, and then France has been upset with Italy because Italy's been allowing them through, and there's a sort of an anxiety about uncontrolled passage into various territories, and all these European borders that have supposedly disappeared with Schengen are all suddenly reappearing, and there is sort of a sense of alarm, but quite often with these things, they can be managed differently. There doesn't need to be a sense of alarm. I personally don't think there needs to be.
I mean, the point that you're making in your book is that these are children, and they are making dangerous and difficult journey because the conflict in their own country has meant that they can no longer have a childhood in any sense of the word. Is there more compassion for children in this situation, or is it still a difficult subject?
I think it's just invisible. I don't think people realise. Personally, I was covering migration. I myself was shocked to find that there were children involved. And they're not treated as children. They're sort of treated en masse as illegal immigrants, in inverted commas. So they end up in the detention centres or on deportation flights, and they're pushed back across European borders. So there isn't necessarily an awareness that there are children involved. When you talk to people, I think there is a degree, probably a great degree of sympathy, but I don't think that it's actually known. That's what's so amazing to me, that there can be such small people involved and that it's just not known about.
I want to go back to the story a bit now. It centres on two orphan boys who have fled Afghanistan. Can you tell me a bit about them?
Orian's 14 years old and he's travelling with his younger brother, Kabir, who's only 8. And they're... I wanted to make it a little ambiguous because, in fact, their family was struck by problems with the Taliban several years before they make this journey. But then the father is killed in a rocket attack, and the whole economic basis for their family kind of falls apart. And so the mother takes the two boys with her to Iran, which is very common. You have this happening a lot in Afghanistan. She has they have cousins in who have fled to Iran, so they go and move in with them. And then things seem to stabilize in Afghanistan, so they go back. And then the mother is killed, and so the boys decide to set off because there's nothing more for them there, and they feel like they might have a chance of going to school in Europe because there's absolutely no chance of them doing that back in Afghanistan, and so they set off following this route that, they've heard other people have gone along and they've been able to get a little bit of advice from someone who's been on it before. But there is this issue in Afghanistan that the families don't actually know what's going on these journeys. They don't actually know what happens to their kids. So they set off on this journey just to try and obtain some kind of future or some sort of stability in some place where they can actually belong and start a life.
They say to each other, where are we going? We're going to go to school, and how are we going to get there? And there's that list that they do, which is Kabul, Tehran, Istanbul, Athens, Rome, Paris, and London. Why is London the dream destination, do you think?
Quite often it's because they speak a little English. Also, they tend to move quite often towards diaspora groups, and I think there's quite a strong Pakistani community in the UK. I think some of them move there and try to blend in and get work and some sort of protection amongst the Pakistani community. They want to go to school, and some of them need to work, and they think that they'll have a chance of getting a job in the sort of parallel economy there, and that the UK doesn't have identity cards, so you can sort of blend in more easily and hide out, unlike in other countries of Europe where you have to have ID on you all the time. So, and there's an unregulated workforce, so they try and sort of slip into that. It's not necessary that all of them plan to go to England. I think they plan to go to Europe, and they have a vague idea of what Europe is about, and then they just are looking for the best place they can go where they think they can find a way to go into school and get some sort of protection, and eventually after that have a chance of earning money.
And this was your first novel. Why was it that this story was more powerful as a fictional piece rather than a piece of journalism, do you think?
Well, it was quite strong as a piece of journalism as well, and it had, I had quite a good response from it, and it went to the front page of two newspapers, and it was, it did affect people, but I felt like I personally had a lot of leftover emotion of having spoken to these kids and heard their stories, and I felt like I needed to channel it into some other form, and that a newspaper story is there and then it's gone, and the next day there's another subject that's grabbing our attention, and the story kind of is lost. And I felt that I needed to put it in some form that would last a little bit more, and that it could all, and that was out of the political domain a bit, because there's so, everybody has a view and there's many points of view involved in the whole discussion on migration. And I just felt like we needed to look at this outside of all the yelling in a kind of a more quiet place where we can really think about what's actually at stake for individuals. And so I just wanted to lift this story that wasn't very well known by the general public anyway, and put it into a format where you really know what people are going through and what they're experiencing and what they're feeling. So the novel seemed the best form for me to try to do that.
That was Caroline Brothers talking about her novel Hinterland, which is published by Bloomsbury Press. Before we go tonight, a review of a classic, and like most classics, one that divides readers. You either love or hate Jane Eyre. And Final Draft's Katrina Menzies Pike has always felt she belongs to the camp that doesn't get the hype. But with the latest film adaptation of Charlotte Bronte's classic hitting screens nationally, she thought she would take another look.
I've always thought of Charlotte Bronte as the lesser Bronte and of Jane Eyre as the lesser Wuthering Heights. Filmmakers don't agree with me. Jane Eyre has been adapted for the screen many more times than The Adventures of Cathy and Heathcliff. Before seeing this year's adaptation, directed by Cary Fukunaga, I decided to reread the novel. The shorter verdict? It's as sappy as I remembered. The plot is very clunky and preaches a sermon of goody-two-shoed righteousness. It's a study of female masochism and of restraint. The narrative relies on a set of pretty annoying coincidences and near misses to keep moving. Unknown characters and surprise letters arrive out of nowhere with good news just when it's needed. It's true, the lead, Jane Eyre, does have some feistiness in her, but it's always subordinate to circumstances. She's mouthy, she's passionate, but she's also very obedient. I also struggle with Rochester as a romantic lead. Yes, he's tormented. Yes, he's tall and mysterious. Yes, he's rich, but he's also sadistic, manipulative and cruel. By this moment, all the Jane Eyre fans listening have probably tuned out. But stay with me. The thing is, for all its faults, Jane Eyre is an important book. It's a touchstone for feminist literary criticism and provides the figure which unifies the important work of criticism, The Mad Woman in the Attic by Sandra Gilbert and Susan Gubers. This book, which was published in the 70s, explores the confined, restrained, hidden feminine, both within literary narratives by women and in terms of the experience of the female artist. There is a mad woman in the attic in Jane Eyre, about whom I'll say no more for those who haven't read the book. When I read the novel, I wished there were a few more mad ladies roaming around, that Charlotte Bronte had let Jane off the leash once or twice, and maybe her own imagination as well. Film isn't always the best medium for picking up nuances and possibilities like this, especially when there's so much plot to deal with. And that does apply to this latest version of Jane Eyre as to earlier ones. Nonetheless, the film is a very respectable addition to the 20 or so adaptations that have already been made. That's in no small part thanks to two very accomplished leads, Mia Wasikowska as Jane and Michael Fassbender as Rochester. Their performances are intense and they stop the film sinking into schlock territory. Look up Orson Welles or Timothy Dalton's performances as Rochester on YouTube to see how terribly wrong it can go. Wasikowska's clear stare is mesmerising and she manages to project an inner life to this heroine which seems almost to extend beyond the prattling narrator of the novel. The director doesn't stress the post-colonial aspects of the narrative in this adaptation, nor does he dwell particularly on the theme of constrained madness, which many literary critics have emphasised. He does spend more time on Jane's childhood, which she passed as the unloved ward of her aunt and in a very grim institution for orphaned girls, Lowood. This is usually left out of the films, and to my mind, it's vital to understanding the mindset of the mature Jane. The way this film depicts the treatment of children in a 19th century benevolent institution packs a real punch. Fukunaga mercifully also avoids some of the real plot clangers in the novel. He smooths out the edges of these ridiculous coincidences which tie up all the loose ends. Purists might not like this, but I did. Visually, the film is very bleak and very chilly. The colour is drained out of the moors and Jane's rough years at Lowood look like they've been shot in monochrome. It works well. The fire motif, however, is picked up with vigour. On the one hand, this is fair enough. It brightens the tone on screen, and there are plenty of real fires in the narrative for cues. It is, however, a pretty obvious motif for the burning passions of our heroine, and I felt it was overused. All up, there's a lot to like about this adaptation of Jane Eyre. It didn't quite shake my reservations about the book, but I do think it's the best adaptation of the novel that I've seen.
That was Katrina Menzies-Pike reviewing Jane Eyre. And that's the show for this evening. Thanks to Eve and Martin Hewitson, Katrina Menzies-Pike, Richard Newsom and Caroline Brothers for the great show tonight. Stay tuned for On the Corner, which is up next.